From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Rise and shine. I'll tell you where to find a unique breakfast here in L.A. It's been an incredibly dry winter this year. Should Southern Californians be worried about water? Find out why your dishwasher is leaving an icky film on your plates today on the show. Plus, could Detroit become the epicenter of the urban farming movement? But as always, let's go check out what's fresh and in season this very first week of March at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. DJ Olson is here today, as he is every Wednesday, shopping the market. He is, of course, the chef at Lou. And DJ, we always love your recipes. Tell us what vegetable you're giving a lot of love to today.
The Brussels sprout. You know, I love to take something to the end of its season because then it disappears. And so a lot of people said, Brussels sprouts, Thanksgiving, then I don't use them anymore. But they're actually really the best right now because the weather's cold. And they're really terrific from Richard at Two Peas in the Pod. The colder it gets, the sweeter his Brussels sprouts are. And the bigger they get, which to me is advantageous for this one salad because we do a shaved Brussels sprout salad. And the little ones are a huge amount of work. The big ones are less work. And actually, I kind of like the flavor of them. The small ones are really great for, you know, heating, like with bacon, the way people like to cook them. But I have this recipe that's a result of my wife telling me that I should do something with Brussels sprouts because I was figuring out what I was going to do for my Monday night supper. And I said, what kind of salad? And she said, do Brussels sprouts and hazelnuts and prosciutto. And I went, wow, what a great idea. So we took it back and we played with it. And we take the larger Brussels sprouts and cut them on a mandolin to shave them very thin. Then we make take hazelnuts and roast them in the oven so they get nice and browned and nice prosciutto. Or you could use speck. We were using speck for a while. But prosciutto is really nice. And then make a hazelnut vinaigrette, which we make out of hazelnut oil, canola oil, sherry vinegar, champagne vinegar, shallot, and Dijon mustard. And then basically just put them all together, dress the salad, toss them, grind some nice pepper on the top, and it flies out the door. It's got all the wonderful things you want in a salad.
So now we don't have hazelnuts here at the farmer's market. Are there other nuts that you could suggest as an alternate if we wanted to be all California?
Sure. Obviously, you could do macadamia nuts. I know we have a macadamia nut person. And you could find macadamia nut oil. I always like to make a vinaigrette. If I'm including oils, I like to use the oil of the nut. We have beautiful walnuts from Rancho La Vina. And that extraordinary walnut oil. So you could do that. But somehow, to me, my wife's suggestion of Brussels sprouts, hazelnuts, and prosciutto was like, it was perfect. It just like a bell went off in my head and said, that's great.
So DJ, thank you so much for that. And it's always great to see you here. And I love your recipes. Thanks again.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was DJ Olson. He's the chef at Lou Wine Bar, which, of course, is the wonderful little hideaway in the mini mall next to the laundromat on Vine, just north of Melrose. Now, DJ loves to talk about what's in season, and he also was talking about a confit citrus tart that he makes with all the seasonal citrus at the market. That's also going to be on the KCRW website for Good Food, along with the great, terrific Brussels sprout salad. Seasonality is one of course, our biggest themes here at the farmer's market, and the Zuckerman asparagus is eagerly awaited. It grows up in Stockton. It's called Delta asparagus, and that, I guess, refers to the very rich soil. And Juan is here with the Zuckerman asparagus for the first time. Juan, is it early or late this year for you?
1 week late.
And tell us about why is this asparagus so insanely popular?
Well, we bring asparagus only in the season time. In cold place up there in North California, Sacramento is the right place for asparagus. In the winter time, it's good.
Now you're the only one that brings in the jumbo asparagus and the purple asparagus. Uh-huh. Tell us what the difference is between the jumbo and the regular asparagus.
Jumbo is come from younger plants. It's why it's tender, sweeter, and better than the other ones. Other one sizes is good too, but not like a jumbos.
So I guess the jumbo, that's the first big stalk that comes up, and then the rest of them, the littler stalks, come later. But this is the first stalk.
Yeah, first stalk.
New plants. Mm-hmm. And what's the difference in the flavor between the green and the purple asparagus?
Purple's more sweeter. Excellent, too. More sweeter. Jumbo's is sweeter, but not like a purple.
And do you have any purple yet?
Not yet. Two more weeks.
All right. Well, we're so happy you're back. All and right. The asparagus really is delicious.
Everybody happy. Everybody waiting for Zuckerman's Farms. Not for me, but for the asparagus, too.
Well, for you, too, of course. Okay. All right. All right, Juan. Well, great. We're so glad you're back. Thanks a lot.
Enjoy your day.
Thank you. Okay. That was Juan, who sells Zuckerman asparagus. Asparagus is a seasonal crop. It comes from Stockton up near Sacramento, and it is prized by everyone. And these young, tender jumbo stalks really are delicious. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
If you want to know what's in season before you head to the market each weekend, we can help you out with that. Every Friday on the Good Food blog, we tell you what to buy this weekend at the farmer's market. I think you'll like it. Check it out. You'll be the first to know what's popping up at a market near you. Up next, are your wine glasses cloudy when they come out of the dishwasher these days? I'll tell you why in 30 seconds right here on Good Food.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. With all the beautiful produce at the farmer's market, you'd hardly notice that this year has been an exceptionally dry one here in California and in many states across the nation. In fact, it's the driest winter on record in the Sierras, and ski resorts are worried that the slopes are empty. But should we here in Southern California also be worried? I asked Adan Ortega, formerly the Vice President of External Affairs for the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California, to explain what it means for the residents of Southern California when the snow doesn't fall.
Well, when the snow doesn't fall, it means that our groundwater levels do not get as high because we have a great asset of natural aquifers in the Los Angeles coastal basin that is fed by snowmelt. And even to this day, we capture a lot of stormwater, for example, off the San Gabriel River, which makes it underground. When it doesn't rain, it makes us more reliant on imported water from Northern California and the Colorado River. But there's a lot of reasons, both environmental and regulatory, for which why we are getting less and less water from those regions. And so we should be concerned, and not just when it doesn't rain. We should be concerned all the time.
Okay, let's start with like water 101. What is an aquifer?
Well, an aquifer is an area under the ground. It can be at different elevations below the ground, anywhere from several feet to hundreds of feet underneath the ground. We have two major aquifers in Los Angeles County, what they call the South Coast Basin, which is along the coast, and the Central Basin, which is further inland and connects to the San Gabriel Basin, which abuts the San Gabriel Mountains.
Are they like giant sort of spongy lakes under the ground?
What it is, that's a very good description. It is kind of like a corrugated box. And what happens is that water accumulates and it moves at very slow speeds underground. It moves like molasses. So it can take years from the time that water gets introduced into the aquifer to the time that it makes it to your tap.
And this is something natural. We didn't build aquifers.
We have a natural asset in Los Angeles County and in many parts of Southern California of having vast storage underneath the ground. For example, Diamond Valley Lake, which is a lake that we use for emergency supplies in Hemet, it's an artificial reservoir that was created, holds about 800,000 acre feet of water. The San Gabriel Basin alone, underground, has over 2 million acre feet of storage capacity. Regretfully, much of it is contaminated with things like perchlorate and other industrial solvents, which makes that water very difficult to access because you basically have to clean it up.
Wow. Water is so complicated. It's so fundamental, and it's so complicated. Let's talk about where we get our water. I think a lot of people see Chinatown, the movie Chinatown, and they sort of use that as a building block for first learning about water. A lot of our water comes from outside the Southern California area. Where do we get most of it from?
Well, Evan, we get about 60% of the water in this region from the Sacramento-San Joaquin Bay Delta, which is in Northern California. The Delta area itself is not the origin. The water comes from as far as Lake Oroville and Lake Shasta. It flows through the Delta. The Delta is an estuary, as you know, and we have man-made levees that basically help keep ocean water out and the fresh water conveying through to our pumps that make that water come south. But, you know, they're in disrepair, and an earthquake can obliterate it and leave us without water from Lake Shasta and Lake Oroville. But I don't think water is as complicated as people make it. This is a show about food, and I think if you begin with food, people will make good sense of why things are the way they are in our region.
What do you mean?
Well, for example, a few people realize that up until 1950, Los Angeles County was the number one agricultural county in the whole United States. We outpaced in the value of our agricultural production many Midwestern states. What happened is that agricultural prosperity took hold and we diversified the crops. We started drawing water out from deeper and deeper from in the basin. And one thing that people that know about food understand very well is that you can't grow food with salty water. So it became necessary to bring water first through the Owens Valley Aqueduct, which the city of Los Angeles built from the Eastern Sierra. And part of the function of that water was to replenish the basin right here in North Hollywood. And then we built the Colorado River Aqueduct to bring water from the Colorado River. And at the beginning, when this aqueduct was built during the 1930s, there weren't enough people here to use it. So they sold the water cheaply to agriculture. And also to replenish the groundwater basins. Because what happens with these aquifers is that if you drain them and they dry out, they compact and you'll never get that storage back. And so it was very important and wise to get that water here, replenish the basins, and then also to pay off the bonds that allowed us to construct these aqueducts by selling the water cheap to farmers. And we still have remnants of that. San Diego County, for example, remains the largest small farming community in all of California. We have more small farms on an acreage basis in San Diego County than anywhere in the state.
And that's because they have access to cheaper water.
They had access to cheap imported water. And with the recent drought that we just ended a couple of years back, the Metropolitan Water District, which built the Colorado River Aqueduct and helped finance the State Water Project and the California Aqueduct, basically removed the discounts from that agricultural water. So we're losing acreage in San Diego at tens of thousands of acres per year. And, of course, it stresses what remains of agriculture in Orange County. We have a lot of nursery, for example, stock in Orange County. And even Los Angeles County has agriculture.
Turning our attention again to imported water, what are the communities from which we draw this imported water? What is there pushback from them now?
It's interesting where the pushback comes from. The watershed begins at Lake Shasta for what they call the Central Valley Project, which the federal government built, and in Lake Oroville for the State Water Project. But the people that claim ownership of the water are not in that region. The people that claim ownership of that water are the people that live in the Delta. And we tend to think of the Delta as Northern California, but it isn't. It's Central California. The problem here is that if we find a way of conveying that water around the Delta, say we install a pipe so that we avoid these levees over to where we take the water to Southern California, what's our motivation for investing in those levees and preventing flooding in communities like Sacramento? So it's not about the water. It's about the money. And the people in the Delta have a very big need, because they're not a big population, in using the aid of the rest of the state to maintain the levees.
One of the things that I find interesting is when we're told to conserve, like at the end of the drought when things were really, really bad, and we were asked as a population here in Southern California to cut our water use by 10%, we actually cut our water use by 30%. Which caused the utilities to raise our rates because they were making less money. Is this a sustainable kind of model, both from a viewpoint of maintaining infrastructure and maintaining fully charged aquifers?
It is not. The model that we currently have, the economic model for sustaining our water infrastructure, does not work because it sends out mixed signals. There's some exceptions, for example, in the community of Irvine, where they have assessed a fixed fee to the residents of Irvine to maintain their pipes. So it doesn't matter whether they sell water or not. They're going to have the money to keep those pipes working for when we do have water. But much of the region doesn't operate that way. For example, some communities, the community I come from in Orange County in Fullerton, we have a 400-year pipe replacement schedule right now because as water rates have increased, we have dipped into reserves to buy the water instead of fix the pipes. The city of Los Angeles is constantly challenged because of the vast infrastructure that they have, and so are many communities, with some exceptions in Southern California. The communities that don't struggle are those that have a fixed charge for the infrastructure, and regretfully, it's easier to do that with newer communities than older communities because, remember, we built the original system when there weren't a lot of people here, so you had to sell the water cheaply in order to get people to use it and to be able to have enough money to pay the bonds. People don't see the full cost of water. When you look at your water bill, you think you're paying the use part, and we don't connect it with the sewer part because your sewer fee is based on a percentage of your consumption of water. And so if you're going to conserve water, you know, you're also going to impair the sewer system. And it's not readily evident to residents. For example, I think something people don't know is that 56% of the revenues that water that the Metropolitan Water District gains to bring our water from somewhere else is gained from water sales. It's not from a fixed rate. So if they don't sell water, they basically don't have money to fix the pipes.
Adan Ortega is an entrepreneur in the field of water management. He was formerly the Vice President of External Affairs for the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. Throughout the month of March, we'll continue to look at issues of water in Southern California and the nation. We've learned over the years that using our dishwasher uses far less water than washing by hand, believe it or not. A win-win situation, if you ask me. But I also noticed several months ago that my dishes just weren't as clean as they used to be. The reason? 18 states have banned phosphates from dishwasher detergents, the results being filmy glasses, stained flatware, and a powdery residue on plates. Brian Sansoni of the American Cleaning Institute joins us to discuss what led to the ban and if dishes will have a spotty future.
The new products, or the new product formats, took some people by surprise, although industry, manufacturers of automatic dishwashing detergents, have been working on reformulation for quite a few years, but it is not easy to replace a workhorse ingredient like phosphates were in automatic dishwasher detergents.
Now, what is a phosphate?
Phosphate, for decades, has been the key ingredient in automatic dishwasher detergents. In essence, it helped remove food and grease, reduce spotting and filming on your dishes. It helped control water hardness, and it suspended the bits of food so they were not redistributed on your dishes. So it was the major ingredient, obviously working with other ingredients in those products, but that was the one that got most of the work done.
Is it a mineral?
Yeah, I mean, it's a chemical. It's a natural a chemical, but has been utilized in products like automatic dishwasher detergents up until 2010 for decades. But in the state legislatures, there were challenges to it and allowed manufacturers to come up with an idea to at least give them time to reformulate products as states started to enact bans on phosphates in automatic dishwashing detergents.
What was the impetus for the ban? Are there environmental effects?
During the past number of years, there were certain legislators and certain activist groups that targeted phosphates and automatic dishwasher detergents, trying to claim that their use were causing water quality problems. Phosphates in automatic dishwashing detergents had a minimal impact on water quality as compared to major phosphorus usage in fertilizer runoff from farms, construction runoff, or poorly maintained sewage treatment systems. But these products were an easy target. Washington State became the first state to actually enact a ban. Other states had tried to do that and failed. Washington State in 2006 was the first one to do so. So at that time, our association and our manufacturer members worked with the legislators there to at least give us enough time, 4 years from that date, to target July 2010 before any such bans went into effect statewide.
You know, it's interesting that we're having this conversation now because I have to say it was just after purchasing my last, my most recent bottle of dishwasher detergent that I noticed that it was finally working as well as the one that was ripped away from me. Are companies substituting the phosphates with one other sort of magic bullet that they found, or have they had to come up with a sort of whole concert of ingredients to do the same work?
A concert of ingredients is a great way to describe it, because what companies did after 2006, companies did an awful lot of research, development, and testing to try to perfect the formulas so consumers would have clean dishes. You also have to remember, there's not just one type of auto dish detergent. There's the powders, there's the liquid gels, and there's the little single-dose gel packs. And, you know, consumers have their different preferences. Each one, you know, is formulated a bit differently. You also had to retool some of the manufacturing facilities. You had to make sure you could source, find the ingredients to try to make it work. And, you know, there's a lot of, trial and error in this. And companies are always looking to try to tweak and perfect the formulas to ensure that the products that are on the shelves do what they say they do and clean your dishes.
Was there a lot of research done as to future impacts on the environment, on the water stream, given that I would imagine the companies would not want to have to go down this road again? Are these formulations more environmentally sensitive, let's say?
I would say from the majority of the ingredients that you see now in the mass market brands and even the smaller brands, yes, you could term them as more environmentally friendly because of just the particular ingredients that are being used. So you do see now that the products have been reformulated, you do see less of an environmental impact, say, than it was with the previous workhorse ingredient. And certainly, you're right, the companies didn't want to go through this again.
Well, thank you so much, Brian. Really interesting information about something that each of us has been personally wrestling with over the sink.
Thank you.
That was Brian Sansoni of the American Cleaning Institute. We've been talking about the pros and cons of recent state mandates requiring phosphate-free dishwashing detergent. Up next, could Detroit be the next epicenter of urban farming? Find out in 1 minute here on 89.9 KCRW and KCRW.com.
This is producer Jillian Ferguson. You can connect with other food lovers on Evan's Facebook page, share photos, ask questions, and meet new friends. Search for Evan Kleinman on Facebook and click like.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm thrilled to see that the urban farming movement continues to have a firm grip on cities nationwide. Novella Carpenter and Willow Rosenthal are two Oakland-based farmers who pioneered the urban farming movement, and I'm so pleased to have them both, along with Novella's adorable infant daughter, in the studio with me today. So one aspect of urban farming that intrigues me is acquiring land. If we want to go beyond a small plot, or if we live in an apartment and have the itch to farm, how do we go about finding available land?
Well, it turns out that in most urban areas, there is a lot of vacant land and empty lots or yards that aren't being used, and even institutional land, such as at churches or community centers, other places like that. And what I found in my many years of acquiring empty lots, which in West Oakland City Slicker Farms, we eventually acquired about 8 pieces of property. And what I did was every time I needed new land, because we were growing food to distribute in the community and constantly needed to grow more. I would just look around the neighborhood, try to find a spot that had a good light and good soil, and then I would contact the owner. And what I found is that a lot of owners of land, they may have a plan to develop it at some point in the future, but especially now with the downturn in the economy, a lot of that stuff is on hold. These people, some of them don't care about their land being used for a positive purpose, but many of them would love to see something positive happen. Think like a landlord. You know, the thing that the landlord is concerned about is liability, and it's not that hard to get a liability policy. And then also, they don't want messes. You know, they don't want to have to deal with somebody who doesn't do what they say they're going to do. So what I recommend is just writing up an agreement, trying to address all of their concerns. And I've had great success with that.
What about if you're a renter and there's an area and access to the roof or there's a big terrace? Do you recommend getting permission or doing it guerrilla style?
The main thing that I think we have to work towards as urban farmers is understanding that if we're working in the community with other people, be it landlords, our neighbors, whoever, we have to be responsible.
Yeah.
You know, we have to kind of do what we say we're going to do or be honest when we made a commitment that we can't follow through with, because urban gardens can turn into a real mess if you don't maintain them.
It's true.
That's not fun for anyone.
And, you know, the other thing, too, is, Evan, you mentioned roofs. That is really complicated. You know, everyone is excited about green roofs, and I'm excited about it, too, but they can be potentially disastrous.
There's a lot of stuff on the internet about that. And I'm really excited about sub-irrigated planters, which basically contain the water and it doesn't even go out of the container.
That's right.
And they're, you know, you can place them along where the beams are in the roof. And
right. And that totally makes sense.
Yeah. And those you can make out of 2 5-gallon buckets and a couple of other readily available materials.
Yeah, I love those.
When you talk about looking for suitable land, explain some of the aspects that make the land suitable or not.
Yeah, it's really important because you don't want to put in a lot of effort and then find out you can't do it. So you need to have sun quite a bit during the day, 5, 6, 7, 8 more hours. And then what you want to do is get onto the land and explore it with some tools, because you can look at a lot and it might look like it's dirt, but a few inches down it may be a concrete slab on the whole lot. So, and that you can garden on top of concrete, but you just want to know what you're getting in for. And then the other thing is you want to research the prior use of the property. So if it was an auto shop or a junkyard or the former site of a industrial factory or something,
right.
You know, that you really don't want to touch that.
Mm-mm.
So let's say we have our farm up and running, we have it planted, and now we want to introduce animals. Novella, do you still have goats climbing up your back stairs to the laundry room?
I do. I was just sweeping the back stairs and being like, God, these goats. But yes, we do. We do have 2 Nigerian dwarf goats.
So let's talk about goats. Are they an easy animal to introduce to an urban farm?
No, I would say on the on the spectrum of difficulty, they would be right up there with along with pigs. You know, like I like to say that there's a certain gateway animals. You know, like that honeybees and chickens, relatively easy. Anyone can raise them, and the goats are definitely way down the end of things. You know, they need shots. They need to have their hooves trimmed. If you're raising them for dairy purposes, you have to have a stud goat come and service the ladies and. You know, so it's complicated, and it can be a lot of work, and so I don't recommend it as the first step.
But let's say we do honeybees, we've done chickens, and we want something next. What about rabbits?
There's a lot of potential for rabbits. You know, people are, urban farming is great. We love vegetables, and it's great to have chickens for eggs. But, you know, then if you're a meat eater, a lot of times you kind of look at your plate and you're like, wow, you know, this is one thing that I'm having trouble raising myself is meat. And I've found that rabbits are just an amazing urban farm animal because, you know, they can live in a more shady area, so you're not taking up valuable garden space. Their manure is like black gold. I mean, just put it on your vegetables and watch them go. They can eat vegetable scraps from your garden and other things from the urban waste stream, like stale baguettes and things like that. And then they happen to be delicious. I mean, there is a little controversy about rabbit and eating rabbit, especially in America, because people think of it's like eating your cat. That's kind of a problem. But, you know, they reproduce like rabbits. And so you have this amazing source of hormone-free, healthy meat that you know that is safe. It is really a great feeling to be able to raise your own meat. And on a small scale in an urban area, rabbits are just really, really a no-brainer.
So let's go from sort of this expansive mentality of really wanting to have a complete farm with vegetables to the smallest kind of farm in containers. You have some really incredible suggestions for container gardening. Take us through what some items we can use to garden in.
Yeah, you can pretty much garden in any container that you can find that's deep enough, has water drainage, and, you know, you like it. So, you know, you can use anything from the bathtub, which, of course, many people have seen, which is a great, great growing container, to old recycling bins, you know, that those have holes in the bottom, or you can mm-hmm. drill holes. You can use 5-gallon buckets are one of my favorite free materials. And quick and dirty is a burlap sack.
Take me through the elements that work together in terms of the root needs of a certain plant, the depth of the container, and how often you feed it.
Yeah, so there's a misbelief pretty much out there about how deep vegetables are. People often say, oh, lettuce doesn't need very much root depth, or radishes or something. But the majority of vegetables' roots can go quite deep, between 3 and 10 feet. So, but in the upper third of that root depth is where the greatest concentration of roots and absorption of nutrients is happening. So you don't have to have a container that's 10 feet deep. You just need to have a container that's, you know, at least 19 inches, something like that. The deeper the container, the less often you'll have to feed it. So pretty much, again, I have mentioned the 5-gallon bucket too many times, but for containers, that is kind of the depth that you want, that deep or deeper.
Well, we will say goodbye to the two of you and the baby.
Thanks, Evan.
Thanks, Evan. It's so good to hear from you again.
Take care.
Okay. Bye,
Hans. Bye.
That was Novella Carpenter and Willow Rosenthal. Their book is The Essential Urban Farmer, a pretty amazing resource for anyone who's got that itch to dig in the dirt. When people think of urban farming, one city that probably doesn't come to mind is Detroit. Detroit is big. San Francisco, Boston, and Manhattan can all fit within its borders, but the population of the city has dwindled in the last half century in relation to its size. It's also on the verge of becoming a food desert, with roughly 80% of the residents of Detroit buying their food at the 1,000 convenience stores, party stores, liquor stores, and gas stations in the city. That being said, Detroit also has open land, fertile soil, and ample water. All the elements you really need for a great farming community. Enter John Hance, a Michigan native, head of a billion-dollar financial firm, and a man who's looking to plant the first seed in resurrecting a city. Working for John Hance is Mike Score, the president of Hance Farms. He joins us to elaborate. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you today?
Really excited to talk to you. How is Detroit positioned to become the world's first 100% food self-sufficient city?
Well, that would be a great vision. And when you look at our portfolio, a lot of the characteristics of Detroit that have been negative in the past actually set us up quite well for being involved in urban agriculture. We've got a lot of land. The city owns over 40 square miles of vacant land through foreclosure. And we have a high chronic unemployment rate. We have a demand for food. It's still a major metropolitan region, even though Detroit's population's been declining, a lot of the population's just shifted over into neighboring communities. So we have a strong market, a good workforce, a lot of land, and we've got great technical support through local universities and agricultural companies.
How many acres has the Hans Group purchased, and how is the land currently being used?
Well, we have land in northern Michigan and land in western Wayne County, but in the city of Detroit, we've only been able to purchase 3.5 acres, and that was a demonstration site for city leaders. They had concerns about the idea of putting a farm amongst remaining residential properties. And so to show them that this can be done well, we purchased 35 vacant lots in a neighborhood of 50, and the remaining lots have houses on them. And then we've cleaned up that land and planted it to hardwoods, apples, and blackberries.
What an interesting mix. How did you decide on the hardwood part of that?
Well, the hardwoods are actually pretty easy. You can make money on hardwoods over time if you have a lot of time. It takes about 40 to 60 years for those trees to mature. But hardwoods can tolerate some soil compaction. Also, we planted bur oaks, and they can tolerate a soil pH up around 8, which is where most Detroit soils are. And people are already comfortable with hardwoods. They're growing all over the city. So we're not introducing something radically different.
And what was the residents who were remaining in those houses that were still there, how did they respond to this pilot farm?
Oh, it's great. And actually, the area used to be overgrown with brush. When we cleaned up the area on 3.5 acres, we removed 430 car tires and 150 cubic yards of household trash. So the brush is gone, the garbage is gone, the grass is cut, and we planted the trees in straight rows so that it's really much nicer than it used to be, much safer, much cleaner.
You mentioned technology at the beginning of our conversation. Tell us about the technology-driven growing techniques that you're using.
Well, in Hans Farms, most of our operations are going to be outdoor operations. We'll have hardwoods, apples, and other fruits, a U-cut Christmas tree operation. But part of our effort is to support a network of companies that are interested in looking at indoor growing systems. And these would be hydroponic or aeroponic systems. And the aeroponic work is really cutting edge. Hydroponics are pretty common, but what we haven't seen in the marketplace are very large, effective hydroponic systems.
Give me an idea of the scale of what you're talking about.
Well, on a large scale system, an indoor system, we would be working to design something that would fill a building the size of a Walmart from floor to ceiling and wall to wall. And you can get 20 crops per year if you're growing leafy greens, which is a simple crop. You can get 20 crops per year in a building that size. So you'd be harvesting well over $1 million worth of produce in a year.
This is kind of an off-the-wall question, but is some of the technology that would be used in some of these very large indoor farming projects coming from the marijuana growing industry?
Well, the technology is similar, except for we're interested in systems that use more efficient pumps and more efficient lighting. So LED lightings are, if you'll forgive the pun, for the future. And we're hoping that LEDs become more cost-effective because they're certainly more energy efficient. And then by using more efficient pumps, we can reduce the electrical use in the systems. They really do use a lot of electricity as they are in the marketplace right now. And for horticultural purposes, on legal crops, we would need something that drives down the cost of production.
How is this idea of for-profit farming beneficial to a community that's struggling so much like Detroit?
Well, Detroit's problem right now is that the city as a public entity owns a third of the real estate. And when the city owns that land, they don't pay any taxes on it, but they do have the maintenance costs. The city of Detroit estimates that the cost of providing basic urban services across the city is $9 million per square mile. And so the owning 40 square miles, in theory, their budget for maintaining that property and servicing it would be $360 million a year. They just don't have that much revenue. And so the city's appearance has been declining. By shifting that land back into the private sector, they'll get cash for this surplus land, and then we'll be paying property taxes on the land annually. So it'll reduce their operating expenses and increase their tax revenues. And then for the people who live in the area, it will look better, and we'll hire some people from the neighborhood to work on our farm. So we'll create a modest number of jobs.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Mike. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mike Scores, the president of Hantz Farms in Detroit. A far cry from the for-profit farming initiative set forth by Hantz Farms is the organization Urban Farming. The group began in Detroit in 2005 with just 3 gardens. They now have planted and facilitated over 57,000, yep, you heard correctly, 57,000 community, residential, and partner gardens all over the world. Founded by Taja Savelle, Urban Farming is an inspirational grassroots initiative that not only succeeded, but thrived against all odds. Taja joins us today to tell us the story.
Well, actually, I was recording a CD for Sony Records in Detroit, and I had never been to Detroit prior to that. And I ended up buying a home outside of Detroit and becoming acquainted with all of the unused land in the city and the job loss that was occurring, jobs being shipped overseas, et cetera. And so I decided to put my music career on the back burner, and I started Urban Farming with a pamphlet and 3 gardens and about $5,000. And we started planting food on the land that I saw. I was sort of drawing from a time in my life when I was a teen when I had lived on a farm. And so when I saw all of that unused land in the city, in my mind's eye, I just imagined food being on the land. So we just started planting. We just started doing it.
Tell me a little bit about your program. Is it technology-driven, or are more traditional gardening practices used?
Well, it's a combination of both. We started out planting sort of old school, just planting in the ground. But we quickly moved into planting on walls and rooftops using various wall companies that work with edible walls. That's what we call them. They're actually living wall systems. And there are a variety of them out there. But the thing about the living walls that's very cool is that they can cut down on up to 60% of the heating and cooling costs of the host building. And they also cut down on the rainwater runoff in a city. They cut down on the urban heat index. And then they feed people. So there are many different benefits. They also provide green-collar jobs. So there are many different benefits to the edible walls, and we were very proud of them when we first got started with those.
When I was on your website and I looked at some of the largest farms you have, the size of them within a city are truly impressive. What are some of the largest plots of land that you're working with?
Well, again, Detroit has, I think, probably more unused land per capita than any other city in the United States. And so these long stretches of land, it makes it easier for us to plant on big gardens in Detroit. And some other cities have quite a bit of vacant land as well. But we have a garden in Detroit. It's the largest garden that we have, the largest urban farming garden in the world. And it's located on Gladstone and Linwood. And we started that garden out. It's an entire city block. It's grown now into more than that. But it started out as an entire city block. It grew into about 2 acres. And that particular site is really one that's close to my heart, because my vision originally was to see these gardens, on the unused land in Detroit, really sort of pocket the whole city and become sort of a trust fund for people of food, a trust fund of food, so to speak. Because one of the hallmarks of the urban farming gardens is that the food is free for the community, and they can just walk on the land and get the food whenever they want. So that particular garden, for instance, when we started it took us 80 semi-trucks of topsoil and compost to create. And so if you can imagine, we had to mow the grass and come in with 80 semi-trucks of this wonderful topsoil and compost, and then we spread it out with a backhoe, and then we planted with a tractor, and we were watering it with fire hoses. And in the beginning, people were coming up to us and saying, "What are you doing?" And they, you know, we had some really interesting responses because people thought that this is in a very, it's in a food desert. So it's a very depressed area of the city, actually the epicenter of the 1967 riots. And so people thought, "Oh, somebody's about to make a lot of money here, but it's not us." And so when we said, "We just planted a really big garden and all of the food is free," I mean, and plus, just like watching us water this dirt with fire hoses, they were really wondering what was going on. And so, but the response was so wonderful. I mean, people broke down into tears and started thanking us and praying for us and just breaking out into laughter and happiness. And as the food began to grow that summer, people would come up to us crying and thanking us. And they were so excited, and they would give us feedback about how this garden was affecting the community, that it was making the people were talking more as neighbors. They were inspired to plant their own gardens. They were happier and they felt more hope. And one of many people mentioned that just the idea of the fact that it's free and there's no catch, we're not asking for anything in return, we're not commanding or demanding that people work in the garden in order to get the food, really, really touched people's hearts and brought hope back to them in mankind, because it was just an altruistic give, so to speak.
Did a lot of the folks who live adjacent to the gardens end up working there, though?
A lot of people do. And the thing about it is that when you're dealing, first of all, urban farming is in urban areas, suburban areas, and we like to say rural areas. So we're all over the world. We're anywhere where you can plant food. But in particular areas in the city and urban areas that are in food deserts that are so distressed, it's really actually, if you think about it, it's kind of cruel to put a garden in the middle of that food desert and put a fence around it and say, guess what? After your hard day of work, where you're making not even enough, anywhere near enough, to pay your bills, and you get home and you're exhausted, now, in order for you to get that lush, beautiful, organically grown produce that you're staring at out of your window, you have to now go work in the garden, too. So we just felt like that's just not cool. The whole idea of a community garden, it's for the community. So if you have the energy and the emotional fortitude after what you're going through just trying to feed your family, I mean, if you're making less than $10,000 a year, you can't imagine the stress that's on people and that people are dealing with. So people that where it strikes a chord or they're able to, they come out and they help. And the folks that are just too beaten down, they don't, and that's fine. They can come out and just pick the food, and that's fine with us. And that's why we get the respect from, whether it's somebody on the street corner that could be in a gang all the way up to a church grandmother, they respect these gardens because they know that they are free for the community. Now, those are the urban farming community gardens, but we are really encouraging people to plant their own gardens at home. We'd like to remind people that during World War II, 20 million Americans planted victory gardens, and they grew almost half of our nation's produce supply. So I always cite that because it is a model that has been done that worked, and it occurred at a time when we did not have the technology that we have now with Twitter and Facebook and even telephones, and they were able to galvanize that many people to actually go out and plant food as a war relief effort.
In the last few years, the Hants Group has come on the scene there in your city. And they say they want to revitalize the city through agriculture. How does this new corporate for-profit presence differ from urban farming's grassroots approach?
Listen, we're all for it. We're for, again, business growth, job creation, and global investment. So if somebody's coming in and creating some jobs and able to grow local food and they're selling it, that's cool too. We love it. And we are all for that.
Thank you so much, Taja.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on the show.
Taja Savelle is the founder of the nonprofit Urban Farming in Detroit. How do you foresee the future of urban farming? Join the conversation on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, and click like. Stay tuned. I've got a breakfast recommendation from none other than Jonathan Gold coming up next after this short break.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. It's the time when Jonathan Gold is here. Of course, he's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Weekly, soon to be at the LA Times. And we're happy to say that he's still our restaurant critic extraordinaire right here on Good Food. We love when he pays us a visit to tell us where to pick up our forks. This week, we're headed out for an early morning meal in Thai Town.
The restaurant I'm doing, Siam Sunset, opens at 6 in the morning. Since a lot of the Thai restaurants in the neighborhood that cater to revelers don't tend to close till 4 a.m., there are a couple of hours in which you have no access to noodles. But I must say that I've actually been there at 6:30 in the morning, and mostly what you see is sort of elderly people who have gotten up to greet the dawn.
And what is Thai breakfast?
Apparently, Thai breakfast is pretty much as any other Thai meal. You can eat anything that you would eat in any other part of the day. But what's specifically Thai breakfast is, I suppose, jok, which is their version of congee, the thick rice porridge, into which you can put all kinds of things, or noodle soups, or actually, and because you have to order these whenever you go, these like wonderful sort of globe-shaped Chinese donuts that come out hot. You dip them in sweetened condensed milk, and they're just glorious.
So it's deep-fried dough that you dip in sweetened condensed milk.
Right. It's not a diet breakfast.
I was going to say how delicious. I wasn't going to meditate on the caloric impact.
No, there's something about being there, especially early in the morning when the traffic hasn't quite started up yet and it's still like a little dingy and cloudy outside. There's all these people around you and, you know, the Thai news on in the corner and the sound of, you know, Thai being spoken from every table. And you dip the hot thing into the condensed milk and you wash it down with this super strong coffee that has also been sweetened with condensed milk. By the way, I'm almost positive the coffee is instant coffee, but the powers of sweetened condensed milk can modify almost anything into something delicious.
This experience kind of sounds to me like that you would sort of come to at a certain point during your breakfast and feel like you're not even in Los Angeles.
No, exactly. I think it feels more like Thailand than any restaurant in Los Angeles does. One of the ways it feels like Thailand is, I mean, I guess the people around you, the usual pictures of the king on the wall, but also pictures of yellow shirt rallies, the sort of political movement. There's Thai newspapers all around. There are Thai phone card things. This isn't a destination restaurant, I don't think. I mean, this would be a restaurant that if you were in Bangkok, there would probably be 3,000 of them. And you would go to the one that was, you know, around the corner from your apartment building. The very ordinariness of it, the very fact that people are here because it's the place where they are rather than it's a place where they've decided to go, that makes it special. It's sort of a contradiction, but it works.
No, I like that. I mean, I find especially for breakfast, those kinds of places, extremely comforting and sort of a gentle entry into the day.
Yeah. So the jok isn't one of these super special flavors exploding everywhere joks. It's very, very plain. You know, it's thick. It's possibly unflavored. And so whatever they put on the jok becomes what you eat. So you can get it with roast duck, for example, and the roast duck juices leak down and they flavor it and it's delicious and everybody's different. Some bites are bland, some aren't. They do the one where they put a raw fish fillet in and the fish cooks in the heat of the broth. And there's a lot of white pepper in that one. And as you know, there's not that much flavor to a small white fish fillet that's been, you know, poached in the heat of
pap.
Like, it's sort of like Asian oatmeal. I always think of juk and kanji like that.
Yeah, but you feel like there's something substantial in your stomach.
Yeah,
it's
definitely
not too heavy, and you're ready to hit the heat of the day. There's this strange other menu that looks like it's been made with a label maker and just slapped on the front of the menu. And it has $3.95 specials, not all of which may technically be breakfast food, but all of which may be eaten for breakfast. And among the ones that are really great are they call it Thai spaghetti. It's a really, really, really soft rice noodle served with spicy green curry.
That sounds marvelous.
It's really good. It's a small bowl and it's light. And you could conceivably get, you know, that and a cup of coffee and be out. And it's like super cheap. There's another dish they call rolled noodles, which is sort of like flat rolled noodles, I guess, that are served on top of a kind of ragu of minced pork and dried mushrooms. That is very nice, and it comes with, you know, ang choy, you know, Chinese watercress, whatever you want to call it. And this garnish I'd never seen before, which is Chinese sausage sliced thin, chopped into like little slivers, and then fried until they're crisp. It's like the bako bits you always wished existed.
It's too bad they don't sell those in bags to go. Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Siam Sunset on Sunset Boulevard in Thai Town. You can get the exact address and all of his delicious recommended dishes by simply texting the words good food to the number 69866. That's good food to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on our Good Food blog. If you missed any part of today's show, don't worry. You can download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand, which is the easiest way, on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. Good Food's produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia and Candace Moyer are our segment producers. The executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.